Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Chinese word for America is Meiguo. Translated from Mandarin, it means beautiful country, and that is the name of a new memoir by my next guest. The book Beautiful Country is the story of a young girl whose parents, both academic professionals, flee to the United States amid Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution. At 7 years old, Qian Julie Wang writes that she, quote, ascended to adulthood at cruising altitude on an airplane. But the country she found when she landed was not as promised. Her father's fear of being discovered as undocumented and deported meant that being visible was dangerous. She taught herself English from picture books and kids' TV. She watched her mother, who was a respected computer scientist in China, work grueling jobs in a sweatshop and then standing in ice water for up to 12 hours at a time and processing salmon at a sushi plant. Beautiful Country is a New York Times bestseller. The paper of record called the book, quote, a window into a family's experience of beginning again with limited resources. Cooker's Reviews called it a potent testament to the love, curiosity, grit, and hope of a courageous and resourceful immigrant child. In addition to now being a best-selling author, Qian Julie Wang is a Yale Law School grad, a civil rights litigator working on education access. Qian Julie Wang joins me now to discuss her memoir, Beautiful Country. Qian Julie, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Allison.
So your earliest memories took place in China during the Cultural Revolution. Your parents were academics, which was very dangerous. It was a dangerous position to be in at the time. But they were more joyful in those memories than you remember them after coming to the United States. How does your adult self understand the position they were in? And how does that, did that affect your memories and the writing of these memories?
Yeah, so my parents grew up in the Cultural Revolution, and the chaos and maelstrom of that experience early in life really affected them and made them angry about the government. Nevertheless, they were able to retain the sense of childlike joy and playfulness. So as long as I could remember them in China, they were always kind of silly and making jokes. Mm-hmm. But the minute we arrived here, all of a sudden I noticed that they started looking over their shoulders, being extremely nervous, like they didn't know what was going on or where they were headed. And because we could not attract any attention to ourselves, it really dulled pretty much every facet of their personalities except for fear and anxiety.
You use, and please correct any pronunciations, please. You use the Chinese word hei to describe your family's undocumented status. What does the word mean and how did it apply to your early life here?
Hei is colloquially what we use to say someone who does not have documents, and it means living in the dark or being blacked out or being pretty much erased from society, and that is pretty much exactly what we experienced during our time living in undocumented conditions because we could not get the access to hospitals, to medical care. We were shunted aside and largely ignored and resigned to working conditions that were patently illegal.
You brought an excerpt to read for us. We appreciate that. Would you set it up for us?
Sure. So this is about my very first experience of Manhattan and Fifth Avenue in the holiday season. New Yorkers can probably relate to the magic and the lights of that time. So I just wanted to share a short 2-minute passage. When we emerged from underground, I was shocked to see that the sun had set. But it took me a second to notice under the lights all around us. We walked a few blocks in throngs of people so thick, it felt like we were back in Beijing. Then Mama led me to the base of the largest, brightest tree I had ever seen. The tree was surrounded by buildings, perfectly framed as I looked up at it against the night sky. Like the one in class, this tree wore decorations, balls and figures of all kinds. Some were lit from within, like Halloween decorations, while others had glitter, and still others shone with their bright colors alone. I went up to one, a gold ball that was so shiny and large that I saw my own face in it. In the reflection, my eyes shone back at me a sparkle that I would carry in my body for the rest of the night. Mama had still more to show me. So she walked me onto the wide streets that had signs telling us that we were on Fifth Avenue. It was the cleanest and fanciest street I'd ever seen in Maegwa. The storefronts were huge and tall, with men dressed in suits at the doors. Some of them were white, some black, but none Chinese. We stopped in the middle of a crowd of passersby, admiring the front of a store that had strings of lights adorning its face. With a twinkle here and a flash there, the lights announced that a show was about to begin. I held my breath and waited, gripping Mama's hand. Out of the corner of my eyes, I caught her smiling as the music began and filled the street. Slowly at first, and then all of a sudden, more lights appeared, one light bulb giving birth to another, then another, before spreading across the entire building, each bulb dancing to the beat of the music. And though we'd never heard the melody before, soon Mama and I began moving with the swaying crowd, shaking gently to the beat, joy vibrating through us. The whole world was dancing, and so were we. We exchanged another smile, and I marveled how, in all the stories of the gold-paved Maegwa and the dangerous Maegwa, no one in China knew about the lights of America, about how they were so delightful that they could stop us in the middle of the street, in the middle of our lives and our worries, in the middle of strangers living stranger lives, all just to fill us with music and hope. Tracing it all back, I know now that it was the moment I first became enamored with the idea of America. It was the first time I saw the beauty and glamour of the country, and really of New York City, though at that point the two were one and the same to me. The lights and the joy among the crowd that night showed me all that the city was and had to offer, a completely different face of America than the one we had come to know. Finally, the beautiful country's name made sense.
My guest is Jian Julie Wong. She was reading from her memoir, Beautiful Country. You know, the way you described yourself as a kid, that you're sort of mischievous, you like to open doors you weren't supposed to, see what was behind them, you looked up at that gigantic tree with wonder. How did those instincts, that natural part of you, come into conflict with the way your parents felt they needed to live life to be safe?
Yes, I wanted this book to be really a celebration of childhood and a recognition of how kids are so much smarter and sneakier than we give them credit for. And one facet of childhood is this inherent openness and just an ability to build intimacy because you're just easily vulnerable and honest. And the conditions of living in undocumented status is completely opposite to that. I immediately learned that there was a central secret to my life that I had to guard at all costs for my sake, for my parents' sake. And because of that, my childhood and my natural instincts were a little bit dulled as a result because of the secret and thus the shame that I learned to intuit from having to keep that secret.
Why did you translate it to shame?
I think anyone can relate to this from having had to keep a secret early in life, especially if it was very early, like mm-hmm. in elementary school. Once you're told that something about you needs to be hidden, the human mind, the human psyche, I think just attributes that to being that this part of me is very different and it is bad, and that is why I must hide it. And so children who are told to grow up with a secret, whether it's being undocumented or something else, they come of age with the need to guard the secret at the core of their identity. And so my shame and the secret grew with me, and I grew around it as I got older. And it became almost inextricably entwined with how I saw myself, how I felt like I needed to project myself in public to keep people at a distance at all costs so they would not look past the veneer and see what was actually happening to me and my family.
You write that America changed your parents. What was a moment that you realized that had happened?
There were two. The first was when actually we got on the plane, my mother and I, so my father had arrived earlier. And it was just me and my mom, and she was very motion sick. and there was no other adult around to take care of her. And for the very first time in my life, I was the one who had to take care of her. Up until that point, she was all-knowing. She had everything in control. As long as Mama was there, I didn't need to worry. And I realized on this plane where I didn't understand what was going on and she was barely coherent, that things would shift. And once kids see that dynamic shift of protecting their parents or parenting their parents, it's very hard to revert. And of course, that thread continued in the United States when I was able to learn English a lot faster than she was just by virtue of my age. Mm-hmm. And I was more attuned to social mores. I began translating for her and just shielding her from embarrassing moments. And for my father, it was really when we landed at JFK and I saw him for the first time 2 years after he arrived, and he looked so small, so skinny, and so worn and tired. None of the joyful abundance that he had once carried with him, none of the mischievous look in his eyes still burned on. It was just exhaustion and fear. And I write when I see him how mm-hmm. small you have gotten. And so being at age 7 and seeing your parents as human and no longer godlike forever changed the dynamics between all three of us.
My guest is Chen Julie Wong. We're talking about her memoir, Beautiful Country. So when you were in the fifth grade, you write that you decided to become a new person and you took on an quote-unquote Americanized name for yourself. What did that decision mean to you at the time, and what did it change for you?
I thought that if I could take on an American-sounding name, Julie, just like if I could speak English perfectly with no hint of an accent, then nobody would ever come to suspect how I arrived here, would ever think about my immigration status. Maybe they would take for granted that I was a natural born American, and that would throw off any risk of suspicion. But with that different name, I also started to concoct these various realities of my life where, oh, maybe I can get away with saying that my father's a CEO or that we're wealthy, and just looking for an escape from really the secret that I had to guard again. And I think that by taking on those little lies as a kid, it felt like, oh, if I'm lying about something as inconsequential as whether I was born here or not, or what my dad was doing, maybe the central secret, this much bigger secret of being undocumented, is not such a big deal because there's so many other little ones. And so I think as a child, it was just my way of coping with the mountainous burden and reality that I was thrown into.
When you were really little and too small to be by yourself, you went with your mother to her job at a sweatshop, and she had been a computer scientist. And you write that one of the biggest lessons she imparted to you was a sense of duty. What did you learn from her about duty?
She did whatever it was necessary to take care of me. So when it became necessary to pay rent and get her daughter fed, and the only job that was available to her was attaching labels to clothing for 3 cents a piece, she did it really without, I don't remember her complaining. I don't remember her throwing a fit. She just did it. She went from teaching the classroom and sitting in front of a computer developing code, one of the very first people to do so, to slumping over a sweatshop machine for 12, 14 hours at a time. And because I saw her take it, that transition, as smoothly as one could handle it, to my childhood mind, this is what you do, right? This is your new reality. You take what comes. And she always told me it's all temporary. Whatever happens is temporary and therefore endurable. So she that to me was what she imparted to me about duty, that you, when you are a mother, you have a duty to your children to take care of them at whatever the cost to you and your body.
Now, because I'm an oddball and I went down a Google rabbit hole on you, is this you in the wedding announcements? She said yes every time he asked.
Yes, that's me.
So we learned your parents went on to have pretty interesting careers.
Yes. My mother has had, I want to say, 15 different careers. She's good at everything.
Sounds like
and
it.
And she's so open, and she learns so quickly. She's a remarkable woman, and was a great model for me that, you know, you truly can do anything that you want to put your mind to.
The name of the memoir is Beautiful Country. I've been speaking with Chien Julie Wong. Congratulations on the book, Julie.
Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.